Live.
We are live. Welcome to another week and the first, well, it's the first, it's the second full week for the show in December, isn't it? We did start last week on a Monday that was the first, so second full week of December and heading toward Christmas. The Santa Jack beard continues to grow, and if you like it, get your full of it, because I've been asked a few times, more than a few times actually, how long does the beard grow and how long does the beard last? Well, the beard grows as long as it lasts, and it lasts until around January the 1st or 2nd, when it will be put back to the standard configuration of a Jack Spirico, which is a well-trimmed number 3 on the wall trimmer's beard. Nice close beard, and that gives you about 2 weeks in between having to really trim it up tight again. But this was something fun we decided to do this year. What does Jack look like as Santa? I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's bad at all. We even have the Santa Jack ball cap that the Spirico Claus ball cap anyway that people are commenting on in the chat right now. So anyway, what are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about what I think is the best preparedness step you can take in your life. And I am probably the only person that is in the dedicated space of preparedness that will tell you this. They'll all tell you things about storing food, guns, bullets, band-aids, beans, remote property, bomb shelter, name it. They'll say it. And whatever their thing is, their place that they ride in life on will probably be what they pick. I was on the Glenn Beck show years ago. And they went around and asked all the experts what the best prep was. Funny enough, everyone that they had said their thing was. So, like, there was a dude there, was a ham radio guy. So he said communications are the most important thing, right? Funny that. There was a dude there from one of the companies that does the storage foods. And he said, well, the best thing is obviously food because we all need it. When it came to me, I said that your skill set and your mindset was what was most important. And that's because it fit the venue, because I would really give this answer over and over again. It's the title of the show today. Success. The best prep you can have is success. And I mean total lifestyle success. I mean where you live, how you live, how much money you make, how much wealth you've built up, your planning and your economic discipline, whether it be through entrepreneurship or building a very non-brittle career with high earnings potential. That is the best. They're calling me Hobo Santa Jack now. Okay. I can live with that. But yeah, like, to me, that is your best preparedness step. I think many come to preparedness, sadly, from a scarcity mindset. You know, at the Survival Podcast, we've always tried to counter that from the beginning. And when I say from the beginning, in episode 1, I said the following: if we prepare from a place of fear, we miss all the wonderful things the world has for us. I mean, really think about that. Episode 1, we're on episode 3,771 today on a Monday. In episode 1, so 3,070 episodes ago, I said that if we prepare from a place of fear, we miss all the wonderful things the world has for us. It's not like this is anything like brand new for me to say, but I think sometimes the message gets lost unless you kind of do the Jack Spirico 2x4 to the head. And so that's what we're going to talk about for us today, right? Bad things happen. Sometimes really bad things. And in some very real ways, some things will probably happen in the future that are much worse than anything that's happened so far. Okay? But I can tell you something about this, like, anti-success mindset in the prepper space, this place people seem to come from of, like, literally they're hoping for collapse because that'll make everybody equal and give them a fresh start, or something twisted in their head. We romanticize the generation that lived through the Great Depression, and it does not help us build resilience. It doesn't. Especially when we romanticize the people who did so at the bottom rungs of society. The people that barely got by at a time when most people barely got by, but they really barely got by, right? Don't get me wrong, I admire their grit. My grandparents on both sides fit that description. They lived through the Great Depression on very modest incomes for the time, right? Not just, you know, everybody had modest incomes unless you were really super rich during the Depression, but for the time, they were at the bottom of the bottom. And that was during a time when they were teens and young adults that they were living through that period. What I learned from about it was simply, it was hard. It was really freaking hard, okay? And as a kid, you know what it never occurred to me to do? And, you know, by the time it would have occurred to me, they were all gone. I mean, I had to be in my 30s before I even started to really think this granular on this topic. But the question I should have asked them was, what would have made it easier? Not what did make it easier. Now that you have the hindsight, so this has been the 70s and 80s. So at that point, they have 50, 60 years of hindsight, right? They're at the end of their life. You develop wisdom as the gray beard grows, right? And instead of saying, like, well, what'd you do? How'd you get through it? Whatever. I wasn't ready to ask that question yet. What could you have done before it happened? What could your family have done? What could your parents have done? And I think I know what they would have said if I would have asked it. It would have been some version of, we could have done more as a family to build more success and financial reserves during the huge boom that led up to it. That if we would have built more resiliency when it was easy, then we would have had a better time when it became hard. Some version of that. I can think of all four of my grandparents, my grandmother and grandfather on my mom's side. My grandmother was the daughter of first generation Italian immigrants that came in, you know, the classic way through Ellis Island. My grandfather was the lineage of German Dutch immigrants that came in before the country was totally a country. That's a big spread there in family lineage and when they got here. And on my dad's side, both of my grandparents came from Ukraine. All the families that lived on the same street together all came from the same village or surrounding area of that village in Ukraine. And they came in around the early 1900s. And they would have all pretty much answered that question the same way. We could have done more. I believe that, knowing them. And they would have all phrased it a little bit differently. My Italian grandmother would have phrased it differently and probably used a couple Italian curse words in it for the fact that they didn't see to do that, right? My grandfather would have just said, we could have done more. I mean, it would have been something like that, you know? My grandmother on my dad's side, the Ukrainian grandma, she probably would have been more eloquent and more thoughtful. But they would all come to the same place, as would have my grandfather on my mother's side. We often also, I think, we look back at the Great Depression and we see it, that's behind us. None of us were alive. You know, especially when it started in 1929, a person that was born in 1929 would be, what, 196 right now. So anybody who really, really experienced the Great Depression is either end of life at this point or they're gone. So we figured that's in the past. And the people that lived through it felt like it was in the past. But did we ever actually recover from it? And is the success formula today any different than during it, prior to it, or what we think of as after it? What if I told you the stock market didn't actually permanently recover from the crash of 1929, not in the 60s, which if you look at a graph is what it looks like, but until 1985, we did not recover from the Great Depression permanently until 1985. Do you believe that? Do I sound like I'm making it up, like I created out of thin air? Well, I didn't. I'm going to show you right now. I'm going to prove it to you. What you're looking at is a graph. Now, this graph only goes up to 2008, but since I'm only talking about when it recovered, 1985, which is right here on the graph, that's long enough, right? Or 2005, but it's actually 2008 the graph runs to. So the blue line that has this exponential rise in and recovers, according to this metric anyway, permanently in 1949, but this is based on the S&P composite. If we were to base this on the Dow Jones, it would actually not recover until like back 62 or 63. But either way, we'll just say 1949, 1950, we permanently got back above the 29 high and never went back underneath it. We had some peaks, you know, here and here as well. But the gray line, which is much less impressive, quite more modest, you can see that in the post-war boom of the 60s, we got above that line a little bit, but we never held it. We dropped back down. It was 1985 that we crossed with the S&P composite, a way that we actually fully recovered from the crash based on the stock market only in 1985 from 1929. That is purchasing power. That is, if you had one share in the S&P, what would it buy you? Or $100 equally distributed across the S&P 500, or S&P composite. When did your purchasing power come back to where it was when you lost it and never go below that again? 1985. That seems crazy, but it's true. And the problem is, your economic experts, what do they point to? They point to the blue line and say, look, for as bad as it's gone up forever, it's never gone down. We're measuring it what? In dollars, while dollars devalue. It doesn't matter how many points the video game gives you. It matters what you get. Like, think of it like when you were a kid and you went to like a pizza place for a birthday party. It doesn't matter how many tickets you get on a skee ball machine. What can you get with those tickets relative to how much money it took you to earn them? If we do it that way, I'm not even sure we ever fully recovered at all. Because I want to ask you this question. If we didn't permanently recover from an economic standpoint based on the value of assets until 1985, and 85 is something we're all comfortable saying, even if Jack's wrong, right? Even if Jack is wrong about this, okay? Is it easier or harder to take care of a family today than 1985? When would you find your life to be a little bit easier when it comes to like buying a house, buying a car, taking care of your family on a single income or like one good income? And then like maybe the other spouse works, but they have a lesser income. That's really common. 85 or 2025. I think almost everybody would agree it's 1985. So we didn't fully recover to 85, but yet it's still harder to raise a family and to provide for a family today, what, 40 years later, than it was when we finally got there by that metric. So that just says, you know, maybe we should ask two more questions. To me, those questions would be, did the Great Depression really end when World War II began the way they taught us about it in school? On some metrics, I'd say yes, but on many metrics, no. Actual quality of life and the ability to retain the value that you earn, it didn't. And if not, have we simply been adapting to be comfortable within a system that began a true decline? I mean, a true decline before most of us were ever even born. And I would say that's a yes. And I don't say that to kind of make the point of how bad things are. Don't get me wrong. My point is only this. Massive fortunes were built between 1929 and 1940. Okay. Before the gear up for World War II. Massive fortunes. And many massive fortunes were built between 1940 and 1985. So if we just go back to 1985 and say this is when we permanently recovered, then you have to acknowledge that everybody that did it from 1929 to 1985, did it while we were still in a depression. And if it's harder now than 1985, then everybody did it between 1985 and today, in that 40-year period, did it while it was getting harder overall. So once we know that, we have to start doing one real thing. And that is, we have got to stop at that point making any kind of excuse out of how hard it is. It's back to what I've always said. It's always been hard. It's always been hard. So we're going to go through that today. We're going to really analyze that. We're going to discover what we should be doing versus what we are doing as individuals. And how that, you know, as I always say, no one's coming to save you. No one's going to fix it. And if you could succeed in 1929, if you could succeed in 1933 or 38, and people did, then there's no reason you can't do it today. Because while there are things that are more difficult economically today, there's never been a period of greater opportunity. Greater opportunity to learn, to market, to reach people, to improve yourself. We have tools available today that our great-grandparents and grandparents couldn't even have conceived of. And I think they would really think that we're squandering things today if they were around. Before we dig into all that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor today, number one today. I picked two sponsors I thought would be good for wealth building today because that's what this is about. JM Bullion is up first. That is where you can get silver and gold. You know, one of the things that your grandparents did have that we don't is at least somewhat gold-backed currency. Nothing really went completely parabolic in the devaluation of money until 71. It got hurt in 13. It got hurt worse in 1933 and 34. And then in 64 with the silver, the Coinage Act in 64, where they took the silver out of the coins, and from 65 forward, the coins are junk metal. But 71 is where it really exploded because the last vestiges holding us to hard money were gone. But you can own hard money. A lot of your grandparents lived through a period of time where it was illegal to own gold. Today you can own whatever you want. I recommend that you take at least 5% of your net worth over time and put it into precious metals like silver and gold. I recommend JM Bullion for the following reasons. One, they sponsored the show that you love for 12, 13 years now. They do a discount for MSB members. Your order is going to ship free. If there's ever a problem, I can get a hold of the owner. And they're very responsive. We just had a code go bad, a discount code from them. I emailed them, and within 12 hours, they had an answer back, and Tom updated the MSB. So, I mean, they're going to take care of you. So check them out today, jmbullion.com. Next up today, somebody that knows a little bit about building wealth, that's John Pugliano with the Wealth Studying Podcast. You want to check John's show out. He does a podcast roughly once a week. Some weeks he does miss, but it is all his insights and what he is doing with his money and his clients' money in the market today to build more wealth. I first met John in 2010. He told me he was going to go away from his career, which is more of a technical career, and move into investing. He felt qualified, even though he knew that I called financial advisors financial liars. He actually agreed with me, and he said, I'm not going to be a financial advisor. I'm going to be an investment manager, and I made myself a liquid millionaire as a blue-collar worker first. I want to tell you something about John's business. Not only does he have a lot of very, very happy customers, he has built a family legacy business in those roughly 15 years since he said he was going to do it. He has built a massive amount of assets under management, and you only do that when you're providing for people in a way that they highly value, because he's working mostly with high net worth individuals. That's the kind of guy you want to learn from, and you can learn more at the Wealth Studying Podcast at wealthstudying.com. With that, let's go ahead and dig on into this. I want to say something about this right here. John Dowie says, hello all. We're in our final week of fundraising for Brian French's wife. Brian was a TSP workshop attendee and passed away young and unexpectedly at 45. He left behind two young daughters and a wife. If you get on the TSP Telegram list and ask about that, there are people who will help you. If you don't want to do that, email me with TSPC in the subject line, whatever else you want to, it doesn't matter. And just tell me you want to know how to donate, and I will get you the information you need so you can do that. Because of the way they're handling it, I don't want to put like instructions on the site. I prefer to kind of just turn you over to the people that can help you with that. I kicked in some money as soon as John and the others got this set up. Brian was a good dude. I didn't know him well, but he went to several of our workshops. And I don't know exactly what happened to him either, but I know that if Dorothy had lost me when I was 45 years of age, it would have been pretty hard. And it's just something that I think, you know, we can do to help one of our own versus, you know, writing a check or sending money to some charity that's going to spend 70-80% of it on administrative costs. So if you are interested in that, either get on the Telegram channel or group, get on the Telegram group or the alumni group if you're an alum from the workshop, Otherwise, email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, and I will help you. Dally says we are at $1,700, which is awesome. But, you know, it's not a huge amount of money, but, man, it's a couple things. And this is why I'm big on building wealth, so that you can help in situations like this. One, when you're in that situation, every little bit is incredibly helpful. And two, for a woman who lost her husband, and I think they have kids. I'm not sure, but I think so. To know that people that she never met valued the person she lost enough to care, that is as valuable as the money in of itself. So please consider helping. Anyway, I want to start off getting into the topic of the day a little bit deeper. And with that, I want to kind of point out something that should be obvious, but often isn't. Dice says that gentleman had two daughters. So that's even more of a reason to help out. Anyway, when you have a disaster, and I don't care if it's something like we were just talking about with a family member being lost, whether it's storm damage, whether it's a massive depression or recession in the economy, a storm, I don't care what it is, an illness and what have you. If you don't die, you are always better off if before the disaster you were successful. Always. Because you had successful from a standpoint, not just of high earnings. That actually can make it worse if it's just high earnings. I mean that you had built wealth. There is no person that was like wealthy, significantly wealthy, and then we went into a recession and said, gee, I wish I would have had less money when this started. Now, again, that should be obvious, but I think a lot of people, because they want to make excuses for either being poor or not building wealth. Maybe they're not poor. They don't live like a poor person, but they're not really building enduring, lasting wealth in their life. Whether they do it through employment or business, I don't care. They want to say things like money's not important. And in the words of Ben Affleck's character in Boiler Room, anybody that tells you money's not important doesn't effing have any. Okay? It's true. You will be better off if you're a success in any disaster. Now, I want you to take what it is, building success, out of it and think about it this way. If you do this one thing, you'll be better off no matter what disaster occurs, unless you die, because then you're out of the game. If it was anything but that, there'd be no resistance to it. Right? If there was a thing you could buy, there was a tool you could buy, and if you bought that one tool, you'd be better off in any disaster whatsoever, no matter what it was, economic, pandemic, natural, it didn't matter, right? You would be better. People say, well, yeah, I mean, if you can show me that, then great. So you tell me what disaster the person with a stable net worth of $1 million, not all leveraged and shit to where when the economy collapses, it goes down too. Person has $1 million in hard assets that even if they came down in value, they only came down in value to $1 million. And they have the same disaster in their life as someone with a net worth of like $5,000. Who's better off? So the one thing we know we can do to be better prepared for things to go wrong is build wealth, period. And Top is dead on here, and we're going to be talking about this today, I promise you. What he's saying is, having wealth makes you better off. Wealth is more than just money. It is more than just money. And I mean that in more than one way. If you only have cash, dollars, you don't necessarily have wealth, because it is a dissolving form of wealth. It's a melting ice cube. That's what dollars are. And if you only measure your wealth in dollars, you could have a net wealth that continues to go up and you can still have a decline in purchasing power. If real inflation is something like 6% and your wealth is increasing every year by 4%, you have no wealth. You have a negative 2% wealth. You see how simple that works. Dowie's saying community, but community building is an incredible form of wealth. But here's the funny thing. People that follow the type of lifestyle that I'm talking about today, they build economic wealth and they build all the other forms of wealth around them. Because part of it is working on you as a person. And you can't control other people. and you never will. So we shouldn't pretend we could. And here's another fact. Much of what we prepare for will never happen. When we get into the prepper space, survival prepping, all of it, like survivalist prepper, you know, homestead prepper, however people say it, like a lot of the stuff, tons of the stuff that people prepare for, never going to actually happen. And at the same time, much of what we fail to prepare for happens every day. There's a guy, he's ready for World War III. He's got a bunker in Wyoming, 10 stories underground or some shit. But he can't handle, you know, losing a job. Why do you think he's rooting for the end of the world? He thinks it's somehow magically going to solve his fucking problems. It's not. It will never solve your problem for the world to end, even if it doesn't get everybody. And even if you're a survivor, you think you're going to be better off with, you know, a death of, let's say, 80% of the population than you are with people alive? You're out of your mind. It's a wonderful fiction is what it is, or a horrendous fiction, depending on how you look at it. So we need to prepare for the things that do happen, and job losses, illnesses, diseases, death of loved ones. This is high on the disaster probability scale. If you've ever lost somebody you loved, you're proof. If you ever got fired from a job, you're proof. If you've been through a depression, you're proof. If you've been through a recession, you're proof. Major economic downturn, you're proof. If you've ever had your house have the roof blown off of it during a storm, you're proof. Your house has ever been flooded, you're proof. I bet you there's not a person listening to me right now or will listen to this show over the next 48 hours once the archive goes out that will not check at least one of them boxes. So it's inevitable that those things will happen. And even if they're not life-destroying or completely life-altering, the successful person is better able to navigate those waters. So it doesn't make sense to call yourself a prepper and not strive to build as much success in your life and as much wealth in your life as you can right now. And the people that say otherwise, they're making an excuse for their their failure, but their unwillingness to apply the discipline that can build success in any life that chooses to apply that discipline. Because it is that simple. It's about making the right choices, including the ones that today cause you to do without. Today cause you to have a hard today. Discipline can be defined as a hard today for an easy tomorrow, where most people trade an easy day today for a hard day tomorrow. Even if their day's not easy, it's easier than it could be if they had discipline. And the longer we do that, the harder the last years of our life tend to become. Right now, more than 80% of people in their retirement years, when they have guaranteed income from Social Security for as long as that lasts, live still in a dependency model. 80% in the wealthiest country, not in the world today, the wealthiest country that's ever existed. So if we keep doing it the way everybody does it, we're going to keep getting the results we always have. Yeah. So as we look at that, how do we correct that? The first thing to understand is there's little hope of hitting a target if you don't define the target. Let's say somebody says, Jack, I want you to pick up that rifle over there and hit that target 50 yards out. There's 20 targets. At least I know what target I'm shooting at, but I know what target they want me to hit. So I pick the gun up, tink, you missed, wrong target. But at least there's targets. If we set no target, Jack, I bet you can't hit that target at 50 yards. And I look and go, what target? And what they mean is a spot on the dirt that they have in their head. And as I'm taking the shot, it's changing. I'm never going to hit it. Most people live their life this way. You know, I say, I want to be more successful. What's your target? What's your goal? What's your defining goal? Like, where, you know, when they say, like, in a job interview, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Hopefully not working for you, asshole, right? If I can't move enough in this job that you work for me or I've gone somewhere else to work better, then I failed. That's how I feel when people ask me that question, you know? I never really answered it quite that bluntly, but that's how I feel. But what I'm talking about, where do you see yourself in 40 years? If you're about 20, I mean, you'd be at least 40 years out. If you're 30, you need to be 30 years out, you know? If you're 40, you need to be at least 20 years out. So many people in that bracket, they're not thinking 5 years, let alone 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Well, those are the years that you're not going to be able to do all the shit you can do right now. I'm going to tell you right now, your physical capability will decline with time. There's a lot of things you can do to keep that, to forestall that, to slow that decline down, and you should, so that you can enjoy it when you get to the point where you don't have to work every day. But most people have no target in mind. So the first step is you got to set a target. Then there's another problem in all of this. We tend to be way more motivated by the negative than the positive. That's both wrong and by design. This is why people gravitate toward prepping. You tell them, hey, you know what? Why don't you build a great resilient life? Oh, no, that sounds hard. Hey, the world could end. Maybe you should buy some food. Okay. Right? That's why I've got a decent turnout today. But I guarantee you, if today's show was the world is ending tomorrow, the number of people in a live stream would 5X just by changing the title. I could even have done this fucking show exactly the same way. I could have changed the title and at least 3X'd it, because people are motivated by fear. And we are put in a natural fear state from the environment that has been cultivated by the rulers of society. The people whose names you never know. No, the rulers of society are not Trump, the king, the orange dictator, whatever you want to call him, or Sleepy Joe, or Barack Obama. Those are not your rulers. The Supreme Court is not your rulers. The senators, the congressmen, all the ones you hate, and all the ones, they're not your rulers. They're not your leaders. Your rulers are the people that write the checks that control those people. Blaming the politician for what the politician does is like blaming the gun for what the person pulling the trigger did. These are mechanisms. These are puppets. The system is completely and fully and wholly controlled. That system of checks and balances they talk to you about, right? Right? The little after-school special commercials. How a bill becomes a law, right? The more you know, all that shit. That's all bullshit. It's all bullshit. Because the people that actually control the society, those checks and balances, it's not the Congress, you know, the legislative, executive, and judicial that are the checks and balances. It's the systems of control through things like regulatory capture, right? So that even if your Congress get the Congress you bought gets away from you a little bit, you still have the bureaucrats. And the presidency gets taken over by a rogue orange man, you still have the bureaucrats and the Congress to use to control the orange man, at least to a degree. And anything that any group that breaks away for a while can do will eventually be undone and put further back and used to actually control you even further because you exist in a state of fear. The reason negative campaigning works, and it does, is because of fear. A society without fear would be like, yeah, shut up and tell me what you're going to do for us versus what the other side is going to do to us. But we can't even think that way. So if we can't think that way politically, we can't think that way in our own life. So we act more on fear than on boldness. And no entrepreneur ever built his success on his own fear. Might have built it on other people's fears, but not their own. They never built their success because they were afraid that they couldn't succeed. So we build success on boldness. We live in a society motivated by fear. So you have to separate from that and become motivated by boldness and motivated by what's possible rather than fear of what could happen. Because again, most of the things we fear can happen never do. When they happen, they never look like we thought they would, and they're never as bad as they were in our head. Do you know why you're more scared in a horror movie where you can't see the bad guy, but you kind of know he's there, than when you can fully understand who the bad guy is? Because your mind races ahead and makes things worse than they are. That's why when you were a little kid, you were scared it was under the bed. There's nothing there, but yet you were scared of it. So all of it was a creation of your mind. And the more you create with your mind, the further you'll go, the more dots you'll connect. And not only does the connection not there, the dot's not there. And the more fear you'll have. So you have to break that before you can ever really build success. And here's another thing. No matter how much class warfare there is, and rage bait is thrown at you on the TV set, in the end, what you do will always be the biggest source of your success and failure. You are more important to your success or your failure than any other human being on the planet or any other group of human beings on the planet. You have a choice. What I'm doing is not working. Fucking change it. Whether you change it to make it better or you take a completely different route, I don't care. If you know what you're doing isn't working, well, they won't let me. Have you asked how you can get around that? Or have you determined if they won't let they, whoever the fuck they are, won't let you, whatever the fuck that means to you? Is there another thing you could do? No, shut up. You deserve the failure you've earned. You deserve the failure you've earned at that point. If you will not adapt to the situation and use things like status jujitsu to get past they, again, whoever they are, because I find this, most of the things people say they won't let me do or some version of that, that is not even real. That is not it. What they're really saying is there are things I would have to do in order to be able to do this. And since I don't want to do the things, it's easier to say it's not possible to do the thing. Well, I can't, put this food product together. Really? Because I see a lot of, well, there's all these regulations. Well, I see a lot of food products. How'd they do it? Not every one of them gave a hand job to a senator and bought him a trip to Epstein Island to get a waiver. Many people just looked at the landscape and said, oh, this is the shit that I have to do. This is the avenue I can take. A lot of times what people mean is that shit's expensive and I don't have the money and no one will give it to me. That's because you can't even sell your plan. You just want to talk to your buddy. There's always a way to do anything that you want to do. There's always a way. And sometimes you can't do it now. But we have to say, is this really what you want to do? Is this really what's best for you to do? And what's the pathway look like to get to the point where you can do it? A lot of times, the things people say they want to do, they don't even want to do those things. They don't want to do those things. No, what they want to do is have money, and they think that that would be a thing that would make them money. So subconsciously, they're creating this arrangement, like a picture board, like a dream board, like an idea board. But the idea board is to prevent action instead of encouraging it. Don't do that shit. We have to, again, be motivated by the positive and understand that we are the sole source of our success or failure beyond everything else. And we also need to begin investing and saving for our future as early as possible. Now, I'm sure you've heard, this is something financial advisors say, okay? And the reason they say it and the motivation behind somebody saying something always tampers with the message. And it often sufficiently tampers with the message in order to destroy the person receiving the message responding to it. So the financial advisors of the world say this, and then they immediately go negative. Because if you don't, you'll be old and you'll die and you'll have oatmeal to eat when you're 60, right? Whatever, you know? But they don't really explain it in a way that says this is how it benefits you and this is how you hurt yourself. Because what they want is more assets under management so they can make a fee off of their assets under management and make more money. And a lot of these guys, they make money even when you lose. Plenty of these guys in that space, that's how they make money. You lose, you win, it doesn't matter. As long as their total assets under management go up, their income goes up. And the goal of a lot of these guys is simply to build up enough under management that I can live off of it. I have my own little annuity now. I don't have to work. All the investments made by my clients pay me. They're not actively engaged. They're not investment managers. That's what John Pugliano meant when he said, I'm not going to be a financial advisor. I'm an investment manager. Most financial advisors, they don't do anything except relationship sales. And that's why this message falls apart, that you should invest as young as possible. Let me make it fucking real for you, especially you people that are 18, 19, 20, the few of you I have around, mid-20s and down. Let me really make this real for you. And if you're in your 30s, you still have plenty of time, you're going to jive with what I'm saying. And if you're like 35, 40, and you've started to hit your stride and you're making really good income, you're really going to be nodding your head, even if you're driving your car listening to me while I'm talking here. The reason it is a sin against yourself, I got five of them. Number one, you work harder for your money when you're young. You do. Not necessarily your total job is harder. Because moving into the world of, like, let's say you move into a world of management and you're actually a good leader and a good manager, right, and a good organizationalist, you're not out there breaking your back with a shovel or a pick or something like that at that point. And you maybe don't work physically as hard. But if you look at what it actually requires to do that job well, not hold down a desk, but do that job well, it's a lot of fucking work. But you're paid really well for it. So when I say it took more work to earn a dollar when you were younger, because unless you have some sort of nepotism or something, we all start at a place that sucks. We all start at the bottom in some way. And the amount of effort put in for $1 earned is significantly higher than the amount of effort put in for $1 earned when you're a high net worth earner in your 30s and 40s. So by squandering that dollar, you screwed yourself out of what that dollar could do for you when you worked harder for it than you do when you're older. And unless your life arc sucks, your life will be harder when you're 21, 22, 23, and your work will be harder, and the amount of effort per dollar earned will be higher. So that's reason number one, you're screwing yourself. Reason number two, you worked under worse conditions when you were young. So you worked harder, but your quality of life while working was probably lower. I mean, I know even when I was in sales, right? Like, it was tough. I worked freaking 70, 80 hours a week. It was hard. A lot of people that envied my job wouldn't have done it. And they certainly wouldn't live with the quota bag over their head, right? But on the other side of it, what do you do other than all the bullshit you have to do and reporting and forecasting and, you know, the tough negotiations you have to get through? Negotiate when you're a good salesperson for a big company, you're negotiating on the client side. You're also negotiating with your own company. Listen, dumbasses, I have the margin sheet. I know we make money on this, and I know if we don't do it, we're going to fucking lose. So I got to make the deal on both ends sometimes, right? But, you know, what was a typical week? Oh, I'm going to go to New York City this week, and I'm going to spend 4 days eating in the finest restaurants. Not so bad. The next week, I got to get down to, like, D.C., so I'm going to take a first-class train down there, and I'm going to go do the same thing all over again. Then I'm going to get on a plane, and I'm going to fly to Chicago for a national meeting, and we're like, it's not so bad. It's hard. Some levels it's soul crushing, but you see what I'm saying? As you move up, generally, the quality of the work environment you're in is better. All of those things were better than when I was packing boxes in a warehouse or scrubbing the kill floor of a turkey farm or busting tires down part-time at Firestone. So not only did we work harder, we worked under worse conditions. And so when we squander the dollar that we could have saved because we pissed it away to make ourselves feel better, we've done a bigger disservice to ourselves. Number three, when you're young, and this is the only one the financial liars even get close to coming in on right, your dollar you put away that you didn't squander has longer to work for you. When you're 35 and you've like hit your stride with income, and you put a dollar away, it only has so long until you're 60 or 65. When you put that dollar away when you're 20, it has a 15-year head start on its brothers that come in at 35. Doesn't mean don't do it now if you're older. It just means you've made a larger error, a larger type 1 error in your long-term financial health. So if you're young and listening to this, consider yourself blessed and get fucking discipline in your fucking life, young man or young lady, now. More on that in a minute, okay? The next is you're closer to the edge, right? You're closer to the edge when you're young. What I mean is the edge of, like, I can only save X amount of dollars, so there's a limited amount I can squander anyway. So of what's left after I pay my basic, like, my car payment, my insurance, my rent, or my mortgage, right? Student loans if I have those, like, all the non-discretionary spending eats a much larger portion of my income, okay, when I'm young. So the amount left, you know, let's say I have $200 I could be saving and investing, even allowing myself some leisure, $200, that's all I got. If I waste $100, if I squander $100, I took half of my long-term leveraged power and pissed it away. If I'm in a situation where I could be saving $2,000 a month relatively easily, and I piss away $500, I've pissed away a lot more money, but I still have 75% of what I can invest in my future being invested in my future. So it's a much bigger sin against me. Notice I didn't say a sin against society, a sin against the angels in heaven, you know, a sin against, I don't know, Gibbers, the crab god that lives behind the planet Jupiter or whatever, right? I didn't say that. I said you're basically committing a grievance against yourself. You're robbing from your future self to have a limited amount of contentment today. And you know who does that? People that don't believe in themselves. People that have a fantasy about their future, but don't believe their own fantasy. So that's another thing. And then, you know how I said develop the discipline today? Here's your fifth reason. Habits are formed early. So you have less economic discipline in total if you start later in life. And what I mean by that is a person who becomes a discipline saver when they're 20 will be an absolute highly disciplined saver and investor when they're 35. A person who takes until 35 become a disciplined saver and investor, and you should if you haven't yet, wherever you are, you start now, but that person is going to take until they're 45 or 50 to become as disciplined as they already would have been at 35. It may not take a full 15 years because you're more mature in other ways. So you may get done in 10 years what you took 15 to do if you started at 20. But you are so far ahead. And now imagine the discipline that will come into your life between 35 and 45. All the while, that spread and what you can put away is growing. And therefore, more of it can actually go to leisure and fun and activities. Because people look at my life right now and go, Jack, you know, you're always talking about like, but you take vacations. You took this trip down to the coast just because you wanted to. And like, you buy stuff. Whatever. Yes, because I can. Because that battery's been built up for so long. But I'll still tell you, I robbed from myself when I was in my 20s. I never put away as much as I should have. If I had, as good as my life is, it would be better. And I made that exchange. The most important exchange we make is with our future selves. And it's the one that they do not teach you about in school. So what should you be doing? Number one, as I said earlier, you have to have a target. So you need to set clear and concise goals for both achievement and personal improvement, right? And we need to have like this big overriding goal, but we also need to have these sub goals, these things that lead us to that point. We need to have goals that are measurable in weeks and months, not just years. So if I want to be able to retire at 55 instead of 65, then I need to have metrics along the way that make me get that done. Then they do not only need to be that I need to have this much saved and invested by the time I'm 35. They need to be things like I need to, you know, learn one new critical skill a quarter. I need to learn one new practical, applicable thing or concept a week. Right. I need to be physically capable of doing the work. So I need to have a certain level of fitness requirement, dietary requirement in my life. See, these are all what you call SMART goals. They're all very measurable and very doable. And you can look at them and say, all I have to do to achieve this goal is do these three things and it'll happen. And you can know that it will happen. And if you don't have that, there's your life arc goal, your North Star goal, as I call it. It doesn't mean shit. It doesn't mean anything. It's a fantasy. It is a way to comfort yourself instead of a way to motivate yourself. So we have to have clear targets, and we have to have the targets. Like, think about it this way. Like, if your goal is to be able to stand offhand with a rifle, optics on it, fine, 6 power scope, and hit a man-sized target offhand at 300 meters. And if you can already do it, shut up and move your target further out. That's where you're at. But you can't shoot at all right now. Well, the first thing you need to be able to do is be able to consistently hit a target at 25 meters. Great. Then you need to be able to hit one, let's say 50. Then double that distance to 100. Then go 150, then go 200. Go 250, then 300. And then you need to set up, well, how much practice do I need to get from each goal to the next? Once you work out kind of what your progression is, you can actually determine about when you're going to be able to do it consistently at 300. If you're ever going to be capable of it, that is. You're not going to be able to do everything that your mind could tell you you'd like to do. I'm never going to be a good singer. If I know that enough that I don't have that as a fantasy goal in my head. I don't have the voice for it. I understand that. I have a speaking voice. I do not have a musical voice. It will never, ever. I would waste my life chasing that goal because I have a physical limitation preventing it. I used to be, as a kid, I was a competitive martial artist. I competed in a lot of tournaments and things like that. I figured out by the time I was in high school, that is not the what to focus on. Sure, you can learn to take care of yourself. You can handle the average person on the street, even people bigger than you. But what you'll never do is in a truly competitive environment, you're never going to be successful long term because that other fighter's coach is going to figure out that you can't see out of one eye and they're going to exploit the shit out of it. And that's a physical handicap you have. Now, maybe someday there'll be a bionic eye and people like me will be able to get past that. I don't know. But right now, no. So it is important to also keep those goals in reality to what you're capable of. But most of the things that you do to truly be successful in life, that doesn't apply. A blind man can become a successful business executive, just to make a point. But he's probably not going to be a successful martial artist, even if he's only half blind. Yeah. The next is, you do need to save money, but you also need to invest in assets. And saving money is a short-term mechanism, or you're saving up till investing matters. Because when somebody says to me, Jack, I have $500 to invest, what should I invest in? My response is, do you have like a windfall $500 and you have other investments? And you're just looking to maybe do something fun or creative or reinforce what you've already done? Or does that $500 mean you have $500 now, but another month you're going to have another $500? Because all of those, maybe we can talk about what you should invest in. No, I don't have any investments at all. I have $500. You need a bank account. You're not ready. Because what's 10% on $500? $50? The time you'll spend figuring out where you can make 10% off $500 to make that $50 this year, you could have just went and made another $500. So your earning power is the start. So you increase earning power and start accumulating cash. Yes, it's a leaking battery, but a battery it is. You know how like when your phone gets old and the battery life starts to decline? Until it really goes off the edge, you don't go buy another $1,200 phone unless you're an idiot, because your battery is, you know, 98% efficient as compared to when you bought it, or even 88% efficient. When it becomes a problem, then you replace it. So the cash is a fine short-term battery. It's great. It loses about 2% to 6% per annum in real spending power. Maybe we could go up to about 8 to 10. And some periods it might be higher, but in general, we're looking at 2 to 6%. That's fine for the short term. If you need it in an emergency, it hasn't lost enough that it's not there for your emergency. An investment has variability. If it doesn't have variability, it's probably not an investment. When people say, Bitcoin, it's too volatile. Volatility is a gift, man. Shut up. You don't understand it. Go do some more work on yourself and your understanding. So first we save money and then we begin investing. And we need to invest in assets. How do you know if it's an asset? Well, there's classes of assets. The reason I recommend Bitcoin and gold and silver is all three are what I consider a pristine asset. And what I mean by it is you can possess it individually. Now, if you're buying an ETF or something on any of those, you can. It's not quite a pristine asset. It's still an asset, but it's not as pristine, right? And it's not pristine because if I am holding iBit, and I decided I like Topcone so much, I want him to have $5,000 worth of Bitcoin, I can't do it. I can't send him $5,000 worth of my iBit shares. I would have to sell them, buy Bitcoin, and then transfer the Bitcoin, because the Bitcoin is a pristine asset. You see how that works? That is part of a pristine asset. The other thing I consider is part of a pristine asset, but not all assets that qualify for this. In fact, most assets that qualify for this are not pristine. Can I borrow against it? Generally, if an asset across a five-year period has a track record of being an appreciating asset, there is some way, shape, or form in which I can borrow against it. That means it's leverageable, and that means it's an asset. Go to your bank and say, look, I want to borrow $5,000. And they go, okay, what's your collateral other than your credit, which isn't the greatest in the world? So I have a pristine leveraged asset I can use for collateral. And they say, what is it? I have $10,000 in your bank. loan me money against it. They won't do it. Crazy, isn't it? I have the money. I can show you I have the money. I don't need the money. I don't want to spend my own money. I want to spend your money. I'm happy to pay an interest rate for that. You have my money. Lock it up if you... Nope. What are you buying with the... You'll end up taking... They'll take the depreciating item you're buying, like a boat, as part of the equity credit to collateralize the loan and your promise, but not your money. But you can borrow against a house. If you have enough equity in a home, you can borrow more against it. You can borrow against Bitcoin. So that's part of being a pristine asset. So we have an asset like real estate. You know, if you're a pristine asset, over time it's going to go up in value. I could totally possess it. I could transfer it without exchanging it for another asset and intermarry first. Yeah. Right. And it has no real cost of upkeep, or the upkeep cost is so small as to be irrelevant to the return. That's why the most pristine asset in the world, whether you want to accept it or not, is Bitcoin, because it does all those things. Real estate has tremendous potential because it has a leverage potential that Bitcoin doesn't. Whereas I can borrow against Bitcoin, right? I can borrow against real estate. They're kind of somewhat equal in that to a degree. But I can't buy Bitcoin with other people's money, at least not in as many ways as I can do it with real estate. I go to the bank. I want to buy a house. Here's my credit. Oh, dude, you have good credit. Yeah. Here's my down payment. Okay. They'll cut me a check that is based on my promise of repayment and collateralizing the property, but they'll do it. Now I can go buy a house with somebody else's money, but I can pay for it with somebody else's money because I can rent it, and that rent pays for the house. Bitcoiners who shit on real estate have no idea what the fuck they're talking about. None. It doesn't mean you should do it, but you shouldn't shit on it. You should just say that I don't want that life of being a landlord. Okay, fine. But don't shit on the class of investment and the asset. But those are assets. Things that you buy that you hold on to that do work for you, that produces value in your life, that exceeds what you paid for them, and they're durable. They don't become shit. Right? This is a cheap ass pair of diagonal cutting pliers from Harbor Freight. I do not consider this an asset. If the only reason I have them is I have tools that I don't use very often, that it's just extra. It sits in a drawer, and therefore the convenience of always being able to find one and not having to go out into my shop and dig through my tools or whatever, it's beneficial. And I also have a tool that I can loan to somebody, and I don't give a shit if they mess it up. This is a convenience item, not an asset. This will be our item of the day today. We'll talk about it more. This is a German-made tool that, unless I'm a tool and don't take care of it, when I die, my kid or my grandkid will use this. This tool is an asset. This tool has already done more for me in value than its cost. So it's an asset. And in some ways, it has characteristics of a pristine asset. I own it. It is mine. Can't really borrow against it. Oh, wait a minute. I actually could. If I have high quality tools with good resale value, it's a high interest loan. I don't want to do it. It doesn't really make sense, but I could at least pawn it. They're selling at a pawn shop, but there's pawning at a pawn shop. I go in and say, what will you, if I have a whole set of these? And they say, that's like a $200 retail set. It looks in good shape. Looks like you took care of it. I know I could sell it for $100. I'll loan you $50 against it. You come back at the end of the month, it's going to cost you $65 to get. It's a usurious interest rate, but at least you can borrow against it. How many things do we think of as assets you can't even borrow against, let alone direct? I can transfer this to you. Yeah. I can transfer these to you. My hand to your hand, now you own it. I can sell it to you, or I can just give it to you as a barter item. I can give it to you as a gift. It is pristine in that way. And I bet you these will cost more 5 years from now than they do today. So even if my used value is lower than full retail, it will have gone up from where it would have been at the time today as a used item already. Yep. That's assets. Without assets, you don't have shit. Skills are assets. Yep. The NIPEX. That's exactly what they are. We'll talk more about them for item of the day today in a minute. That's why they're sitting there. So you got to save money and invest in assets. You're not investing when you save money. You're saving or you're investing. Bitcoin should be part of it. Anybody that doesn't like that, anybody wants to argue it, anybody wants to get butthurt, All I'm going to tell you is I've been saying that since 2013, and every time you've objected to it, if you've been listening that long, all of a sudden it's cost you money and wealth. So do what you want with that information. Then you need to consciously either build a business or consciously build a career with full intent all the way through. If you don't want a business, I understand. It is not for everyone. It's something everybody can do, but it doesn't mean it's something everybody should do. I believe anybody who wants to can, but there's a couple things. You have to have skill or the willingness to develop skill, and knowledge or the ability to develop knowledge. Everybody has that, but everybody wants to apply it that way, right? And you, but the big thing you have to have is you have to have a burning hunger, a burning passion that when shit goes wrong, not if shit goes wrong, you'll get through it. You have to be able to be in a position where you are willing to do what it takes that I know I'm going to take a loss in the third quarter. And I'm going to be okay with that. I'm going to have to not pay myself the third quarter. Businesses take losses. The loss, if not permanent, can be an advantage to the business long term. But you're going to take losses in business. You're going to have meager times in businesses. You're going to be riding a high of everything going right, and something's going to kick you in the balls running a business. That can happen in your career, but nowhere near. It hits you different. When your business goes broke, you don't just get another business, right? When your job goes away, if you've done all the other things right, getting another job usually isn't that hard. There's points in your life, like I think it's very dirty when a company throws away a guy who never did anything wrong, worked hard his whole career, and they throw him away at 57, 58 years of age. It's a sick, horrible thing to do, but it's also, that's the risk of staying in a career. So part of your career design should be, what if I'm in that upper age area and they let me go? What's my transition look like to some sort of consulting or other type of performance of work? Otherwise, you end up this way. So I had a friend, guy actually worked for me. This is kind of sad when you think about it. I was in my early 20s. This is back when I was in telecommunications as more of a technician level before I went into sales in it. And I worked for Lockheed. This guy's name was Delbert. And he was retired and had to go back to work. He worked at Texas Instruments. He had a good, solid, blue-collar income. Really solid. And he worked until he, you know, basically Texas Instruments said, "You're done, man." He was like 55, and they kind of showed him the door. But he didn't care at first. He had, like, all I got to do is figure out the next 5 years of my life to where I can start drawing from my pension at 60 without penalty. And then, you know, another 5 years, I'll have Social Security. But that's why he still couldn't afford to start taking away from his retirement for those next 5 years. So this dude was 56 years old, and I was the lead tech on his crew. And I was like 22 years old. 22. And this guy's 56 years old, 57 years old, working for a 22-year-old kid. You know what he made for his time? $14 an hour. Now, this is 1994, 95, right? But still, a guy that had worked that long, making 14 bucks an hour, pulling cable through ceilings, putting jacks on. Hey, they hired him to do it. It paid his basic bills. But I'm sure he could have probably planned better for that potential. So if you're going to do the career thing, you have to have, like, especially those last 10 to 15 years. What if? If that's not part of your plan, your plan's wrong. So that can be, you're building up so much technical certification and things like that, that there's always a place for you to go, or so much skill, or so much independent talent, that if you had to consult, like, how much better would it have been for that guy if he could have consulted in some way, shape, or form for those 5 years? I mean, his life ended fine, right? He at 60, I was gone by then, but I know he was gone by then too. So I stayed in touch with those guys. And he went off to his little ranch he had already paid for, watched his cows walk around, and lived the rest of his life. He's probably not still here. If he is, he's in his 90s, right? But that's a choice we all get to make. Are we prepared for that eventuality? How much success did we really build? Just having income alone. And even being, he was a disciplined saver. And they had a good pension system there. It wasn't really a pension. It was more like a 401k, but you take some of your money and you bought Texas Instruments stock, and they did the match thing on the stock beyond the regular match. He was in good shape. He just wasn't quite good enough to take hits on the withdrawals yet. He needed those five more years. Next, you need to think about things in blocks of sevens from time. This is the seventh generational thinking. So I think everything you do, now, let's be clear about what I mean by that. That has impact. That's a significant choice in your life. Can be run through the sevenfold filter, generally speaking, really, really fast, because most things won't make it very far. And then you'll be like, I just want to do this, so I'm going to do it, right? So seven generations is about 160 years. It's very hard for us to think out that far that we'll have an impact. And until we start thinking about the next 7 minutes, we can't think about the next seven generations. 7 minutes is too short. And I wanted seven blocks in this filter. So the first block is 7 hours. If I do this thing, will my life be altered in the next 7 hours for good or bad? A lot of things are going to, yes, it'll be altered and you'll be happier in those 7 hours. That doesn't mean to do it. What does it mean to 7 days? 7 days is kind of like a pay period cycle. It's going to, like, you're young. But what will this mean for my rent? The bills are due. Like, this is the last week of the month. Like, that's about as far out as most people think at that age, right? Seven days, next pay cycle. Can I make it? You should ask that question, right? And if it's going to have a problem in 7 days, it's creating a seven decade problem, by the way, or it's weakening your position across those 7 decades, one or the other. Everything that sets you back forever, at least on some small point. It doesn't mean you can't recover from it. It doesn't mean that you can't even do it once in a while. But think about it. So we got 7 hours, 7 days. Next one is 7 weeks, just under 2 months' time. What could I do for myself? Maybe not even just with this one decision, but collectively, if it was part of other good decisions, would I be in a better position 7 weeks from now if I didn't do this? Or will I be in a better position 7 weeks from now because I did do this? And I can't answer these questions for you, right? Then 7 years. 7 years is like a good number in a career arc. Like, if I'm going to spend the money on an investment for a certification, do I think I'll still even be in this career in 7 years? If it's significant time and money, because time's an investment too, and time's the one thing you can never get back, I can always re-earn money. I can never pull back time, right? Then maybe if I know I'm not going to stay here, if I know this isn't going to, if that initial, that credential, that cert won't mean something to my career 7 years from now, maybe I shouldn't waste my time on it. I did it because everybody pushed me to do it, including people I was working for. I got a whole list of certifications in the telecom industry. I was an RCDD, and then on top of that, you had to do the RCDD first. I was a LAN specialist, local area networks, and an OSP specialist, outside plant. The first test for the RCDD had a 70% first-time failure rate because I put everything into it. I studied for it for about 6 months, and I passed it the first go. The other ones took about 3 months to get ready for. And then I had to constantly do these continuing education credits for each individual one to keep the standards body happy. And about 3 to 4 years after it, the career choices I made those certifications mean nothing to me. All in, I would have been better off taking the money and the time spent on acquiring them and doing them somewhere else. If I was thinking this way at the time, and I wasn't, but if I was, would I even have been able to determine that? I don't know. But my gut is I would have. I would have said, this isn't going to do enough for me to be worth it. And so I wouldn't have done it. And just not doing it is not enough. Then what do you do with the resource? So 7 years, right? Then 7 decades. What does this mean over 7 decades? That pushes you. Now, it might be further out. You might be gone in 7 decades if you're 50. Not one of us make 120. But by thinking out 7 decades, we're going to be thinking about, well, you got to kind of make the gap between 7 years and 7 decades, right? So what does this look like 5 years before retirement, at retirement, 5 years after retirement, right? And then you can ask the seven generation question. And that basically is, what does this mean to the people I'll leave behind? to the son, the daughter, the granddaughter, grandson, and the great-grandchildren I'll never know. And if you don't have kids, then nephews, nieces, etc., or the world at large. What does this matter? Many questions won't make it to 7 years. Many won't make them to 7 months. Do it anyway. Because once you get to the point where it's not going to affect anything in 7 months, you can stop. This little tiny thing that seems to be so selfless. Seventh generational thinking is the most selfless thing you would think a person can do. But it's also the most self-serving thing a person can do. Because if I'm making good decisions for seven generations, I'm also making good decisions for 7 hours, 7 days, 7 months, 7 decades, right? I'm making good decisions for all those things. And the 7 decades is a beautiful time frame, because the odds that anybody is going to think this way at all before 20 are very low. And by the numbers, not many people make it past 90. So for most people thinking this way, it is to or very near the end of your life. If you're 30 and you're thinking 7 decades, you're thinking about your 100th birthday. It's very, very powerful to put your mind through that process. I've spent a lot of time in my life thinking about these things, not so I could tell you what to do, but to make my position stronger and then share that with you so that you could adapt it to your own life and make it stronger. You notice my methodology is never, you need to do these 10 things. There's certain universals. You do need to save and invest money, but did you notice I didn't tell you you need to save your money at this rate or you need to invest in Bitcoin? I said you should. But if you choose other investments, as long as they're good, I'm okay with that. I don't tell you allocate 5% this, 10% that, 25% this, 40% that. Go into a 60-40 common stock portfolio. That's, I'll tell you, don't do that because that's dead, right? That was the pension plan for 50 years. It doesn't work anymore. They won't tell you that either. But if you want to do it, you can still make it sort of work if you're smart about it and you throw enough at it. Do what you want, but know why you're doing what you're doing and make the decision based on thinking out in those blocks of time. Next, never buy a thing because you might need it unless you can truly classify it as a form of insurance. Like the likelihood is high enough and the value of the thing is high enough in that situation that I can look at it the same way I look at putting insurance on my car or my home, even if it's not a direct insurance policy. It's a self-insurance policy. Okay. So I'm not going to buy stuff just because I might need it even as a prepper unless I can figure out like, well, does it do something for me if nothing goes wrong? Huh. Now, Jack, that's a new thing for you. Really? My clunky tagline? I endured the clunkiness of the tagline since day one. Because nothing fit, even as a brand expert. And I would say I am a brand expert. I don't say I'm an expert about all. When it comes to branding and marketing, I'm a fucking expert. By any measure that you measure it, right? I hate saying that because I hate calling anybody or myself an expert, except the experts on the council, because they're my experts. So of course they're. No, you get what I'm saying? Like when people start calling themselves an expert, it's uncomfortable for me because it's being a braggart. But I know. Okay, I'll be a branding specialist instead of an expert, right? I know that a good strap line is at best 3 words, and I'll let you add an end in there for flow and not count the end, right? The real thing. Probably know exactly what brand I'm talking about. Just do it. You see that? Do you think that they followed the Jack Spirico rule, or do you think this is a universal rule of branding? Think of any major brand you know and they have a 3-word strap line. Always 3. And if you can do it in 1, you've really done something. And yet I have helping you live a better life if times get tough, comma, or even if they don't. A good strap line does not have 14 words. A good strap line does not have a fucking comma in it until it does. And that was the whole point of that. From the first day, I'm giving you the same message that I'm giving you today. When you buy something from a preparedness standpoint, you should be asking the standpoint, but what if nothing goes wrong? And then if you can find a use for it, it helps you when something goes wrong. It damn sure makes sense to buy it because it does something for me with utility now and in a problem. If the answer is it doesn't do anything, what happens if I don't have it? And the thing I'm concerned about, there's another one, kills bugs dead. I guarantee you, if you keep thinking of the big brands, right, they all have three word taglines because the human mind balances around them. It's a scientific marketing and branding thing. That's what it is, okay? Kills bugs dead, yeah. But when you ask the question, if something does happen and I don't have this, if you're like, the cost for it as an insurance policy is justified, then buy it. Don't buy it out of impulse and fear. That includes, yeah, and see here, quality job one, top comb. Quality is job one, right? Those modifiers like is and. Like I said, you can get that in there, right? But if you, those little, the words you would leave lowercase in a title of a book, are, you can have one of those and is, right? But no more, and no more than three real words. And then you have that balanced marketing slogan, unless there's a reason. And that's why the reason was there. Maybe just so one day, 20 years down the road, I could do what I'm doing right now and point to it. Yeah. Now, hey, somebody got one. So we got a forward one and it worked but why did they break the rule? They had a plan for what to do with it. Less filling tastes great, right? If you're 80s, 90s guy, you know, that's Miller Lite, right? But what did they had something to do with it. And it was a better, you actually made it better by adding the word. Very seldom is that true. It's the exception, not the rule. And it's still very short. Yeah. All right. But never buy a thing just because you might need it, unless you can truly can't classify it as an insurance purchase. Otherwise, it's just an impulse purchase. Insurance purchase, check mark. Impulse purchase, big X, okay? Then you need to start doing something almost nobody does. You need to see dollars only as potential power, okay, and assets as true power. The dollar has the potential for power. It has no power by itself. It's a leaking, weak battery leading everybody in the world of corporate business management with the slogan, cash is trash. So they only needed two real words and one modifier. Cash is trash. Because they know it will decline in value. It has tremendous potential for power, but it's very limited in what it can do. And the only way to get power out of it when it is in the form of cash is to let go of it. Yes, I can buy a public official, but I don't have the cash anymore. See what I mean? So it has now the public officials owe what they owe me becomes my asset. If I'm straight up bribing legally, which we call lobbying, the cash became the asset. The cash was used to actually leverage an asset. Now I can leverage the, if they don't renege on what they promised, right? Because writing that campaign check for $50 isn't going to do you any good. You call up your congressman or your senator or whatever after you contributed $50, $100 and you tell the page, I gave Senator so-and-so $50. Like, that's great. He appreciates it. Click. Right. So it has to be a significant amount of cash to create something with leverage in it. When it's spent into the asset, whether that is the ability to make a phone call to a zoning official who can give you a variance, who will because you did it, even if it's wrong, still an asset, still can be leveraged. And then how long can I leverage it? And when does the leverage end? That's how I evaluate the asset. Okay. The asset has that power. And another way to think about this, they did teach you this in school. They just didn't tell it to you the way I just did. You learned it in science class, probably about 6th, 7th, 8th grade. If you're a little bit slower in a school, as a school district, maybe 9th, 10th, physical science, potential energy and kinetic energy. Cash is potential energy. You expend kinetic energy to receive cash. So you have now potential energy to use in the future. When you put the cash to work for you, you create kinetic energy and you either release the kinetic energy. That means I bought something. Okay. I spent the money on a thing that is not going to have value in the future. That's spent. If I bought an asset, that's an investment. I let go of the money for something that moves forward without me. If I buy equity in a company who's building shareholder value over time, the energy is being used. It's acquiring more value for me while I'm farting. It's acquiring more value for me while I'm sleeping. If it's not doing something like that, or then it's just potential energy. It is not kinetic until it's creating a return and has the ability to be leveraged. I don't know why they wouldn't teach this to you when you're in school when 11th grade, Johnny. Yeah, it seems like it'd be a good idea to do. See, I think the problem is so many people, especially people in power, think this would be dangerous if the people of our country knew this. It would be dangerous to their system of current control, but even they would be better off. See, they're acting in fear too. I don't want to lose what I have, right? The sniveling little shit Lindsey Graham, who is willing to be a war profiteer, is making his shitty decisions, even though he has more money, from the same mindset as the poor person working really hard, but they don't want this other thing to happen because they'll have a little bit less. I don't want to lose what I have. Instead of thinking about what I can build, being 100% ethical and gain from that action, I'm thinking about what I don't want to lose. Where does most of your energy go? To building more or to holding what you have? And just because you're getting more doesn't mean you're building more, right? Getting more is just simply your current activities are resulting in more things coming in, right? But you're not actually building anything of value. When you build something of value, that's when you're actually unleashing the power of kinetic energy, or you're using your money to purchase a share in something that somebody else is building value with. That works too. But when you're thinking, I have to keep what I have, you start making really poor decisions, like withholding information that would benefit others. Because this would benefit, like, imagine a society that made it a mandate that when we take children for about 16,000 hours of their life in school from K through 12, 13 years, and we don't mandate the things that really improve their quality of life and therefore the world as a whole, what are we doing? What are we doing that we don't do that? Sure, I believe in academic standards. There should be a certain mathematical standard, a writing standard, an English. But how much of what we teach people in school will they never, if we're honest, they'll never use? They will never, ever use. I guarantee you most of you would not be able to pass a test that you got an A on in history or science or math. Pick one of the three subjects that you're weakest in. You passed it with an A in 11th grade, and you wouldn't pass it today. Not because things change. You get the same test with the same grading key. You still wouldn't pass it. Or you'll get a D on it. You only got an A on it back. What does that mean? It means you didn't retain it. And if you don't use something, you don't retain it, right? So what's called a perishable knowledge or a perishable skill. We look at tactical weapons like rifles, shotguns, and pistols. If we do not go to the range, if we do not practice, our skill level declines. But there's an order of perishability, and the most perishable of those skills is with a handgun, because it's the most difficult skill to master. It's the quality of your performance goes down the fastest without practicing it. So we need to be utilizing all of these things in our life that benefit us, and we do because we have to. If we use something, the knowledge and the skill are maintained and built. So if after 30 years you have no concept of what you were taught, you were never taught, you had short-term memory of the situation, and the reason you didn't maintain the knowledge is you didn't need it. Gee, I guess they really don't want to tell you that in school. That would lead a lot of Johnnies to go, I need you to explain to me, Mrs. Smith, how I'm going to use this when I'm 35. Well, you will. That's not a fucking answer, because I learned logic and reason too. And that's not an answer. I want you to give me a concrete example of a 30-year-old me using this thing. And if you can't, then I'm not going to waste my time and energy to learn it. And that will either be, here is a concrete example, or here's the things you'll be doing at that age. This is what most people will need to be able to be doing. And this, maybe you don't need it directly, but it is a, you need to know this to be able to learn this, to learn that, so you could do this. Okay, those are both good answers. Never the answer you got, is it? Because they don't have a fucking answer, because there isn't one. For so much of the filler fluff and bullshit that we put into schools to make students feel like it's challenging, and to make parents feel like they're getting their money's worth of all the property tax being stolen from them. Well, they believe that little Johnny's going to go to college and be a professor, or whatever it is they believe in their life will make them feel good as they live vicariously through their child instead of building their own life. The whole system's built on this. What did I say back in the beginning? Right? Much of what, no, that people are more motivated by the negative than the positive. And it's by design, right? My last one for you. With those goals you set, when you look at your goals, if none of them scare you, if none of them intimidate you, if none of them make you second guess yourself, if none of them give you pause, is that, can I really get that done in 7 months? If none of them do that, raise your fucking goals. Notice I didn't tell you what goals to set. Notice I didn't give you a difficulty number or something like that. Your goals need to be at least a 9, whatever. No, bullshit. That's subjective. If that's the measuring stick, if all the goals you've set for yourself, if you don't doubt yourself at all as being able to accomplish any of them, you are not stretching and you're wasting your potential. Ideally, all of your goals would be just at least a little bit uncomfortable. And a few of them would be like, I really don't know. And one of them's like a real, like, I'm really going to have to want it. That will put you in a constant state of a little bit of discomfort with your personal accountability. And if you stick to it, therefore a constant state of growth. You know the old term growing pains? Growing pains is a twofold thing. Children act, and boys more than girls, it seems, just straight up have physical pain. Like really common is like the shins, the legs, that especially young boys will have as they hit a growth spurt. Because that bone is growing and it's somewhat painful. But it's also things like, you know, your first love, your first best friend that does you dirty and really turned out to not be your friend. Like there's a lot of shit that goes on in growing up that causes different types of like physical and emotional growing pains. But if you think that's confined to childhood, that's because you're a perpetual child. And so you think that the growing pains can go away. That's what I often say that, you know, a lot of people say everybody's a 12-year-old today. Not everybody, because freaking progressives are 5. I don't understand why everything can't be free, because you're 5. I don't understand why everybody can't succeed, because you're 5. 12's not much better, but it's better than that. And so you need to, see, here's the thing. When you were a kid, you probably got through a lot of those painful growth experiences because other people held you accountable. Your parents, your elder siblings, your coaches, your teachers, right? You had all these accountability mechanisms placed upon you. Well, growing up is becoming your own accountability, overseer. And accountability always is you need to do this. And if this isn't a little bit more than you think you can do, where's your growth? Where's your growth? You know, I exercise here now, you know, than I have for years. But when I was young and I like lived in a smaller place and I didn't really have the equipment or anything, I used to go to a gym, like a normal everyday gym. And I did a kind of a mix of cardio and weight training. You know, I was never trying to be the gym bro, like, oh, look at me. And I was never trying to be like the person that could run a marathon. I wanted to increase my performance. But I would notice something. Like I would get on one of those stair machines and I'd put on this really hard program and I would do that until I could do it consistently. And then I would increase it. And there'd be these people that would be there on, a, you know, like an ellipse or a stair or a treadmill or whatever. And you get to where you like recognize, like you kind of go at the same time every day. They go at the same time every day and you recognize this person that's always there. And they got on that treadmill and maybe they ran it for 30 minutes. And anybody looking at it without paying attention would be like, they're getting a great workout. But since you observe them every day, you realize like they do the exact same thing every day. They never turn up the intensity from where it is and they barely sweat. That's better than not doing it. I'm not mocking. I'm just saying like that person is in maintenance mode. They're not in a growth mode. They're not improving their performance. So you cannot grow as a person with goals that are easy to meet. They should be reachable. They should be doable. There should be no excuse for not getting it done. But if it doesn't require some discomfort, some form of growing pain, it's not growth. It's at best maintenance. And generally speaking, when we fall to trying to stay where we are, we don't push ourselves, we begin to decline. You're born with a terminal illness. It's called life. And it's true of all of us. If you're 1 year old, 10 years old, 50 years old, every single one of those people at the end of the day is one day closer to the day they will die. It is absolutely indisputable that that's the case. The 50-year-old has less time than the 10-year-old or the 1-year-old, unless some tragedy befalls them. But it is a constant in life. That day is gone. They're one day closer to death. Your day of death is your day of death. Whatever it is, it will be. And every day in between that's gone, it's gone. You're one day closer. But there's another way to look at that. It's a little bit more encouraging. An organism that's not growing is dying. As long as you're growing, you're still living. And you don't really start the die as the decline until you stop growing. And you grow first physically, like just get taller, you know, older, more mature. You know, a 7-year-old is not going to father or mother a child. They're not physically, they're not sexually mature, right? So they're not going to be able to do that. So there's certain things that just won't happen. You won't grow a beard when you're 7. You just won't, because you're not mature enough to have facial hair yet. I mean, there's anything wrong with you, just you're not there yet. So, but there's a point where we stop that. We don't get any taller. We don't get any hairier unless we let it grow, right? And then we begin to physically, at some point, our physicality begins to decline. We can forestall it. But I don't care if you work out every day. You know, I've seen some dudes that are in their 80s that are in amazing physical condition. But assuming they took care of themselves their whole life, they're not even in the condition they were in when they were 55, let alone when they were 35. That's a reality. But there's other ways to grow intellectually. There's no reason to cease intellectually growing until we have the state of mental decline. Sooner or later, right, the entropy of a human life cycle will hit us all. So the number one way to forestall that and even to improve the quality of the end of life period is to grow as much as you can while you can. And you can't grow unless the growth requires some level of discomfort. If you're completely comfortable with your goal, raise it until you're not. Do not raise it to the point where you're like, I know I can't do this. Raise it to the point of, it's going to take some real effort to get there. This is the beauty. When you, if you fail that goal, you'll still achieve more than if you set it to where it was absolutely achievable in your heart, mind, and soul from the beginning. Like it was like, I'm going to do this. It's going to be easy. No, don't allow that to happen. It's not right. With that, guys, I'm going to start wrapping up today. I really appreciate you guys for being here with me today. I hope you take these messages like this to heart. A lot of this has to do with the work that I'm doing to write my next book and the work that I've been doing to help people develop better skills as entrepreneurs. And on that, I want to remind you that on the 22nd of this month, that is Christmas week. So even if you're not going to be tuning in or anything, you need to be ready for this. The Become Dangerous with ChatGPT course will go into its third round. The first two rounds sold out so fast. that Tom had to manually shut down, and we actually oversold them a little bit. And it was less than 2 minutes each. I don't see any reason it would be any different now, because there's more people that want in than wanted in then. If you want any chance of that, you need to pre-register for it. There's a link in the show note, the video notes below. If you're watching this after it's live, go over to the Survival Podcast with that link and check. Just go back and you'll find this if you scroll down from the survivalpodcast.com or go to jackslaws.com. And up at the top, you'll see a little ticker where you can click to register for the course. And the way it's going to work is about 15 minutes before the orders go live, a link will be sent to everybody who registered only, okay? And when you go there, there'll be a countdown. And when it hits zero, it'll go, and it's a race. And you try to get in. So if you want to take that course, remember that. Next up, if you like shows like this, you're going to love my book, Laws of Life, Ditch Your System, Design Your Life, available on Amazon. If you go through T-Spaz, you'll help us out even more. I'll get a few extra pennies if you do that when you pick it up. But at any time, you just go to Amazon and search for Laws of Life, and you should find my book. Put in Spearco if you need to find it, and you'll find it. Next is the fact you can help us out by doing your online shopping at T-Spaz. This time of year, there is absolutely a ton of shopping going on, you know, because it's Christmas, and we do that. It's time for Santa Jack to make his rounds, right? And so if I don't care what you're buying, please consider going through tspaz.com if you're shopping online. But today's items of the day are the Knipex Cobra pliers. And I have heard conflicting evidence that it's Knipex or Knipex. When I look at it, the way I know how to speak English, K-N is N, so Knipex Cobra pliers. These are so good. And if you look at them, they kind of look like a channel lock set of pliers. You'll never buy the day you touch this, the day this goes in your hand, you will never buy a pair of channel locks ever again. And for those that are on the video, let me show you why. So here is a set of these, and there I just changed the size, and I want it to be smaller, and so there I changed the size with one hand. Right? I can literally expand them and contract them with one hand. And once they're locked in, see they stay? You know what they don't do? You ever use channel locks? And you get the size you want, and you move to the next thing you're grabbing with it, and they move, and they get in between, and they bind. This does not do that. This doesn't do that. And that's just the beginning. This is the 5-inch one. These are great for EDC. There's actually a 4-inch, a smaller one than this even for your EDC. Look at the gap. Look at the gap that you get with that. On a 5-inch pair. Look how big that gap is. Isn't that crazy? This will easily get around the nut on a garden hose. And I say that because it's probably the primary thing I use them for. And they make them in much bigger sizes. Yeah, check this. This is the size I wasn't asking you to get loose size. But there's more. These things here, it's kind of hard to see, but they have teeth like a snake. They are curved backwards. And so let me show you something. Let me pull that graphic back up, and let me show you something. And this is true. It works. That's how strong they grip, that a man could stand on a pair of these on a pipe and they won't slip. I don't know that I would try it with these smaller ones, but with these bigger ones, it definitely works. That's because the harder you push, the harder they bite. But because those teeth are directional and back, when you give it just a little release, it works like a ratchet. It'll turn damn near anything. And you want to talk about jaw width. Guys, these things, dig that. Look what you can get on with a 12-inch pair of these things. Channel locks do not have that width of jaw, and they're not controllable with that width of jaw. See how, like, even with that jaw that wide, look at my hands completely together. I'm not like this, like trying to make it work. I have full control. I can actually get back. See how the back handle is a little bit longer than the front? I can actually push and lever down with that. They're German made. I wish we built something like this in America, but we do not. These are the highest quality tools I have ever put my hands on for this format of tool. And they make a great gift, and they make a great investment. That's what I was saying earlier. This is an investment, because unless you leave this layout in the rain or lose it, it will work for decades. And you'll get your value out of it. So they're not cheap. They are not something you're going to see at Harbor Freight. You know, 30, 40 bucks a piece, depending on what size you buy. But there's some pretty good deals available right now. I think it is the five piece set. No, it's the three piece set, which is a 7 1/4 inch, a 10 inch, and a 12 inch. And again, these are the 12s, is on sale right now for like 60, I'm sorry, 100 and I gotta look it up. I don't know. Anyway, it's a good deal. Just read the thing. I know I changed the price today and now I don't see it. So I'm blanking out a little bit on that price, but I have all the honor. It's the 5-piece set, 5 inch, 6 inch, 7 1/4, 10 inch, and 12, $168. That's, if you want a full set, that's the way to go. If you want a little bit smaller or larger, then just buy one off for that. I would tell you, even though I went ahead and did it to evaluate them, the 5 inches, buy the 5 or the 4, depending on what meets your needs, because it's a little bit redundant at that lower size. But that is a great deal. Gals, if you have a husband that's kind of a handy guy and he loves tools, that 5-piece set at $170, that'd be a hell, and I mean a hell of a Christmas gift. It really would. So check those guys out. Anyway, I'm going to this Second Light Farms is the EDCs, the 5-inch ones. They're amazing. They are. They're fantastic. I got the 4-inch ones because I have this little pouch, EDC pouch that I carry with like a titanium pry bar in it and a small knife and a screwdriver, like a multi-tip screwdriver and some other things. And I'm going to tell you, I know a lot of you guys love your Leathermans. I know you do. I know some people like they have like all the Leathermans. They customize the Leathermans or there's some version of the Leather, you know, like a different brand, but they're basically the same multi-tool. None of, now they're great because you have like a needle nose and a wire cutter. And so I'm not saying not to carry them. They can't do what this little tool can do. They will never have the power, the leverage capability that one of these does. You're not going to, when you have that garden hose you need to remove from a faucet, as an example, and you just can't turn it. It's too much friction. It's been on there too long without being disconnected. You're not going to get the wire, the needle nose from a Leatherman on that and turn it. If it's really on there tight, these, it's not even a thing. And that's just one example of something they do. And again, the fact that you can use these one handed is pretty impressive to me, because try that with a pair of channel locks. Okay. I've sold for NipX long enough today. Anyway, I want to wrap up. I want to, again, thank you guys for tuning in today. I really appreciate you guys, for tuning in today. I want you to take what I had to say to heart. And I don't ask this as much as I should anymore, but please, if you want to really help us out, yeah, you can do these things and put some money in our pockets. Number one thing you do is share our show and our work. Let somebody in your life know that there's a crazy prepper that's not really a crazy prepper, who actually cares about people and has dedicated the last 17 years of his life to helping people live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. That means so much to me when you guys do that. And keep sharing your success stories with me as well. Every day, on average, at least once a day, I get an email from somebody whose life is a little better for the message that we teach here. So keep sending those as well. That's another form of dividend in life. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with another episode. Oh, wait, I want to say one thing real quick. Somebody, Second Light Farm, comment. A dedicated episode on goal setting would be great, especially with January 1st coming up. We'll do it. We'll make it happen. I think that's a great one. And Amy threw me $20 and says, thanks, Jack, gas money. I really appreciate that one as well. So thank you for that, Amy. I really appreciate you. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with another one. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.